From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. An elderly husband and wife are getting ready for bed. "I've got a craving for some ice cream," says the wife. "I'll get you some," replies her husband. "What'll it be?" "Vanilla with chocolate sauce." "Write it down, you'll forget." "I won't forget. Vanilla ice cream with chocolate sauce." He goes off and returns with a paper bag, which he hands to his wife. She opens the bag and pulls out a ham sandwich. "I told you to write it down," she says. "You forgot the mustard." That joke got Ronald Reagan a big laugh at a political dinner in 1985. But it sounds a little less funny with every new Alzheimer's diagnosis. Even Reagan himself eventually fell victim to the disease. Today, Alzheimer's and the mysteries of memory. From the science of forgetting to the history of nostalgia. Also,
I love you, you love me, we're a happy family with a great big
Barney. But don't throw yourself out the window yet. The secrets behind annoying songs later this hour. First, a portrait of an epidemic. An estimated 5 million people have Alzheimer's disease in the United States, and that number will only get bigger as the baby boomers age. David Schenck is the author of The Forgetting. He says cases of Alzheimer's go way back in history.
The earliest one I was able to find was the sun god Ra, who was reputed not only to be immortal and omnipotent, but eventually senile. That was 2800 BC, by the way. So there's several thousand years of recorded human history, and pretty steady at that, of references to senile dementia. Not until the 20th century did we start to think of it as a disease, which of course is only a social construction. It's us deciding as a culture that this is now something that we want to fight, that it's a disease, and as a medical community, it's important for us to fight it.
So it really was this century when it finally began to be realized that this was a disease and that we could begin looking into why it was happening. What was the instigus for that?
Well, the conventional history starts in 1901 when a woman named Auguste D. walked into a mental hospital in Germany with these symptoms that we now recognize as Alzheimer's disease, these bizarre short-term memory problems and some confusion and some paranoia. And her doctor was, in fact, Alois Alzheimer, who was this outstanding, gregarious, very creative, hardworking scientist and physician. And the extraordinary thing that happened at that time was that he not only followed this woman's condition, this woman's progress, as it were, deterioration through several years, but then after she died, he was also the one to look inside her brain, and he was the one to, for the first time, notice these strange plaques and tangles that had accumulated in her brain.
Tell me more about the plaques and tangles. What are they? Where do they come from? Do we know?
Where do they come from? That's the $9 zillion question. They do not exist in any other disease or natural form. The plaques are these strange kind of black, sticky balls of goo that are made up of this substance called beta amyloid. They know roughly how they form now. They don't know what actually starts the process. That's the problem. But these plaques form in between neurons, outside of neurons in the brain. And the tangles are these long, stringy strands, these malicious strands that are formed from a substance called tau, and those form inside neurons. So it's kind of the 1-2 punch. You get the neurons kind of being squeezed out from one another on the outside by these plaques, and on the inside, the tangles are basically destroying the neuron from the nucleus on out.
Now, it was only at the beginning of this century that we began to recognize this was a disease, and I suppose that people weren't paying much attention to it because we didn't think many people had it. Has the number of people who suffer from Alzheimer's increased, or are we simply more aware of it now?
Oh, it's increased dramatically, and that is the story of us taking it seriously. Of course, I mean, it's always a personal tragedy when something like this happens, and I'm sure people in 2000 BC didn't like their, you know, 80-year-old loved ones, didn't like to see them deteriorating like this. It's just a horrible experience to go through. But only in the last 20 or 30 years have we had to take it seriously as a society because the numbers have gotten so big. And the reason the numbers have gotten so big is simply a function of how long we're living. At the beginning of the 20th century, life expectancy in industrialized countries was in the 40s, and now it's in the 70s and rising rapidly. And so as a result, we have this whole enormous new population of older people, and the percentage of those people who are getting Alzheimer's It's the same percentage, but it's just a much larger group of people.
So how big a group of people is it now, do you know?
In the United States, in the 70s, there was an estimated 500,000 people at any given time that had Alzheimer's disease. Now it's an estimated 5 million.
And that's just in this country?
Just in the United States, and we're probably talking about something like 12 million worldwide. And this is before the big jump. The big jump comes after the year 2011, when the baby boomers start to turn 65 and start to get this disease in significant numbers.
So I suppose this means for the first time we're going to have generations of people who are never going to get out of the business of caregiving. I mean, they send their kids off to college and then turn around and take care of their parents before they, in their own lives, need to be taken care of.
That's absolutely right. And you just see this time and time again, exploring the lives of caregivers. It's just so common for women, particularly for whatever reason, to be in the situation where they've literally, just, as you say, just sent their kids off to college and, you know, should be in the prime of their life with a whole new amount of freedom and, you know, exploring new possibilities. And lo and behold, their elderly parents are now having to be taken care of, and not just taken care of for a disease that will, you know, go away in a year or two. We're talking about a disease that lasts 8 to 10 years on average and can last a lot longer. So it occupies an entire decade of these caregivers' lives.
You mentioned earlier that it's been around for a long time, long before anybody knew to diagnose it. You even suggest King Lear might have been a victim of Alzheimer's?
Well, King Lear, you know, the Shakespeare scholars get upset when I talk about this because I don't want to assert that the play is about Alzheimer's disease. It's obviously about this family drama. But the fact is that there were some 50 versions of the Lear story before Shakespeare himself tackled it. And in none of those cases did senile dementia come into it. The character of Lear was not as old, and he wasn't senile the way he is in the play in Shakespeare's version. And in fact, what historians have done is located an actual case of senile dementia. This fellow named Brian Annesley, who was taken care of by his youngest of three daughters, in fact. The two older ones were trying to get at the money, and the youngest one was actually more concerned with taking care of the father. So it mirrors the play in that way. And this person would have been in Shakespeare's social circle. So actually now, if you go to the restored Globe Theater in London, they've got a reference to the Brian Annesley case in the brochure if you go to see Lear, as I happen to do this summer in London.
You open your book with an anecdote about Mark Twain going to a dinner to have fun with Ralph Waldo Emerson, and coming out of it ashamed, I guess, because he discovered that Emerson may well have had senile dementia.
Yes, they invited Twain to skewer Emerson and some other wonderful Brahmin writers. And I guess maybe the inviters didn't know what Emerson was going through either, because they probably wouldn't have asked Twain to do this. But certainly Twain didn't know what was coming his way. He got to this hotel and started one of his famous long tales after a dinner at midnight, and for a long time drew out this tale about three miners who had taken on these literary names. These were, you know, poachers, basically, and they were doing bad things to people in the mountains, and one of them was named Emerson. And he, in the course of this hilarious speech, he skewers Emerson by taking his poetry and turning it around and making Emerson seem like this kind of bawdy thief. And Twain was shocked to see that no one was laughing. No one laughed at all. It was just dead silence. And he ended up sending letters of apology and got a letter back, not from Emerson himself, but from Emerson's daughter, who explained that Emerson had neither understood nor remembered at all what had happened in that room. And that's one of the reasons why there was so much silence.
Jonathan Swift, who was famous as a satirist, apparently suffered from Alzheimer's as well. And he knew it and wrote about it. Is that right?
Jonathan Swift is one of those people who was deathly afraid of senility throughout his entire life because he'd seen his uncle go through it and made several predictions that that's what would happen to him. And unfortunately, he was right. Before that happened, before it even began to onset, but as he was getting old, he wrote a poem about himself called Verses on the Death of Dr. Swift. And in part, it reads, "Poor gentleman, he droops apace. You plainly find it in his face. That old vertigo in his head will never leave him till he's dead. Besides, his memory decays. He recollects not what he says. He cannot call his friends to mind, forgets the place where he last dined." So if you know anything about senile dementia, you know that he knew a lot about it and was clearly...
And he knew what was coming.
He did. He did, unfortunately. And he was correct about his fate.
So is there hope for a cure? Are we on our way? I mean, no one researcher whispered to you 10 years till a cure. Is anyone else that optimistic?
there is hope. There is absolutely hope. Only in the last couple of years has there been any hope. There are just thousands of scientists spending millions and millions of dollars in research. And now, of course, it's a vital race for pharmaceutical companies because they sense a lot of profits in the making here. They are going to cure Alzheimer's disease. I don't know when it is. I can tell you that I'm 35 years old, and I'm very optimistic that for my generation, if Alzheimer's is around by the time that we reach our elder years, it's not going to be recognizable because I'm sure there will be some treatments that are much better than they are now. Whether or not they're going to come up with something to help the people who might be getting the disease in 10 years, well, that's the big question. It's this giant race, maybe the best scientific race of all time, against the clock to try to beat this disease before the disease mushrooms in the brains of baby boomers.
David Schenck spoke to me about his book, The Forgetting. Coming up later this hour, how memory tricks us, and longing for home, the heart of nostalgia.
In the Russian army in 18th century, there was an epidemic of nostalgia, so then the Russian general said that we're going to bury people alive if they continue complaining of nostalgia, and apparently he buried one soldier alive, and the epidemic stopped.
One thing we know for sure about Alzheimer's disease right now, there is no cure. But David Snowden says there's still plenty we can do to prevent the disease. Snowden began the now famous Nunn study back in 1986 and has recently written a book, Aging with Grace, about the experience. He told Steve Paulson how the ongoing Nunn study works.
For the last 10 years, about once a year, nearly 700 Catholic sisters throughout the United States are mentally and physically examined, and we also gather information from the convent archives about their early and middle life. And when each of the sisters dies, they each agree to a brain donation. So we can put all this information to look at how early and middle life and late life factors relate to mental and physical function, as well as brain activity and brain diseases, as well as longevity.
It's remarkable that all of these women are willing to donate their brains to science.
Well, I think they all have been touched by Alzheimer's disease. It could be a former mentor or teacher who's an older sister who may have had Alzheimer's, or a friend or family member. And most importantly, they're the school sisters of Notre Dame, so they're a teaching order, and they really believe in the power of education. And that's what we're about, trying to understand what we can do to live a longer and better life with good mental and physical function. So we get along really well with the sisters.
I know you have gotten to know many of these nuns, and in some cases they have become friends, and they've actually stocked your room in the convent with beer. Has that been important to do this study, to really connect with them at a personal level?
Yeah, it's very unusual in science and medicine to get close to the people you're studying. And the very first Notre Dame I met, Sister Carmen Berg, 15 years ago, She told me that I really would have to get to know the sisters and let them get to know me, and that we really couldn't treat them as research subjects. And that was the best advice I ever got on doing human research, and it's been a wonderful part of it.
Now, one thing I find fascinating about your study is the importance of what we all do early in life. I mean, I can understand the value of being active and having an intellectual life when we're 70 or 80 years old, but you're really saying that what we do when we're 10 years old and 20 years old are important down the line.
Absolutely. That brain, the first 12, 13 years of life, is really undergoing sculpting. It's developing, and parts of the brain are taken out if certain things are not in the environment. If your parents aren't talking to you, then it would appear that you don't need language, and so the language part of the brain may be muted or may be sculpted out. I mean, it literally, there's parts of the brain that are sculpted out that as you get closer to sexual maturation. And after age 12, there's still some modeling and some changes in the brain, probably up into the 20s. And then it doesn't necessarily get set in concrete, but it's kind of like, you know, wet cement. It gets pretty somewhat inflexible. And so that early year, those early decades are extremely important.
I want to get back to this question of what people can do with their children up until they're 10 or 15 years old, because I'm guessing that virtually all kids talk with their parents or their peers. And I guess I'm wondering how important it is to raise children in a particular way so that they develop the right kind of brain?
Well, our linguist for the study, Dr. Susan Kemper, she says that the best way to build good linguistic skills and good vocabulary is by reading to your children.
You mentioned the importance of diet. Do you know whether certain foods are particularly important to eat to help protect our brains?
Well, this is a growing field looking at nutrition, but Alzheimer's is it's a brain-wasting disease. You know, parts of the brain, the thinking parts of the brain, are actually damaged and destroyed, and the brain actually shrinks. It's called atrophy, and it's this damage to the brain and death of the brain tissue that causes the symptoms of Alzheimer's. So it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that if you've got a brain-wasting disease, you probably shouldn't nutritionally deprive the tissue. And there may be particular nutrients, vitamin E people have looked at. There's some evidence it may be protective in Alzheimer's disease. The nutrient we've looked at is folic acid, which is a B vitamin found in spinach, and now it's found in breakfast cereals and multivitamin pills. And folic acid is very important in the development of the brain during fetal development. Our study and several other studies are now suggesting that folic acid may also be important in the maintenance of the brain. I'm fairly certain that there's other nutrients that are also important in protecting that brain from being damaged in Alzheimer's. So the bottom line is probably eating a multivitamin pill every day, but also eating lots of fruits and vegetables. There's lots of protective factors for a variety of diseases in fruits and vegetables. So, you know, there's some of these truisms like, you know, eat your vegetables, that I guess they didn't get handed down generation to generation if they didn't have some merit.
Have you figured out how important emotions are in all of this, and particularly people who suffer from depression?
It's been known for some time that people who have clinical depression, untreated depression, have a high risk of stroke and heart disease. At the other end of the continuum, hostility and pathologic anger, also those people have a high risk of heart disease and stroke. Our data and others are now starting to suggest that kind of our everyday emotions that we may be expressing may also be playing a role. What we've now reported a few months ago in a medical journal was that the sisters who were very hopeful, that those sisters lived about 10 years longer than the sisters who wrote very nice autobiographies, but they were more like a business letter with not much emotion. What we think is it's kind of part of the attitude of the sister that when they do have stresses, we all have stresses, even nuns have stresses daily, that when they have stressful circumstances and the heart starts pounding and the blood pressure raises and there's lots of changes in the blood that would increase the chance of having a stroke or a heart attack, that when people who are optimistic and positive in their emotions, that when they do have stress, they still have those reactions, but they come back to normal. Their blood pressure and heartbeat and blood clotting and so forth will return back to normal quicker because they've got a kind of a foundation by which to kind of put that stress into context.
Did you find that the nuns who were especially social, who really liked hanging out with other people, talking with other people, were they less likely to come down with symptoms of Alzheimer's?
That's a hard one to study. I mean, for example, a couple years ago, a European study suggested that people who travel and who knit might have a low risk of Alzheimer's disease.
Who knit.
And, you know, I'm sure you could think of some complicated neurologic way in which knitting, you know, activated certain parts of the brain. But people, as they start to develop Alzheimer's, before they get the diagnosis years ahead, there's changes in the mind and the thinking and in their feelings. And so that they can, you know, slow down their knitting and not travel. It's hard to travel and knit when you are developing Alzheimer's or when you have it. And one of our sisters, Sister Mathia, who was 104, she knit a pair of mittens every day. And I thought about, well, if you really thought knitting prevented Alzheimer's, then was it the knitting that she did when she was 6 years old or when she was 104? Again, these are kind of lifelong habits that we develop. So I don't think knitting prevents Alzheimer's, but I think Alzheimer's can cause people to become socially isolated because it becomes embarrassing if you can't follow a conversation and be part of the conversation. So a lot of people will withdraw as they develop Alzheimer's, withdraw from the social world. That just makes matters worse. One of my favorite sisters, Sister Nicolette, she has a sister who has the symptoms of Alzheimer's, who's also a nun, Sister Ursula, and several times a day she goes up and spends time with Ursula trying to keep her connected in the world of, you know, what day is it today and what did you have for breakfast, and trying to keep her engaged. And it takes a lot of patience for from both Nicolette and Ursula to do this, but it's all part of trying to stay connected. And therapies for Alzheimer's patients, in many ways, it may not change the biology, but it's trying to find something that they do that they can find some reward in, whether it's playing a piano or dancing. Or I know of some people with Alzheimer's who can't talk really, but they can still sing the old songs. So taking pride and being part of the world is important for all of us, and I think it's even more important as these brain diseases like Alzheimer's start to kind of chip away at your human features, human characteristics that we value so much.
Steve Paulson spoke with David Snowden about aging with grace. Mission Impossible is one, but there are lots of other sticky tunes out there. If you've ever been driven to distraction by annoying songs running through your head, keep listening. A new study is cracking the code on stuck tune syndrome. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. So, recognize this one?
I like to be in America, occupied in America, everything free in America, forest for me in America.
That's Leonard Bernstein's tune, America, and please don't get me wrong, I like West Side Story. But does it have to keep running through my mind for hours at a time after I hear it? James Galaris, a professor at the University of Cincinnati, is trying to figure out why some songs get stuck in your head. He told me why America is one of the stickiest songs out there.
I think it's the incongruity in the meter. It's organized 3 plus 3 plus 2 plus 2 plus 2, and that irregular pattern, I think, incites a kind of cognitive itch in our brains.
So it's really kind of a compliment to the song that it gets stuck there because it's out of the ordinary?
Yes, it's a wonderful song. It's catchy. Of course, catchy can be good or bad.
Are there other songs that you've come across that are like America, that that kind of share that same property of being out of the ordinary?
Brubeck's Take Five would be in the same category with an irregular meter. Incongruity is not the only attribute of songs that make them likely to get stuck in listeners' heads. There are other attributes as well, such as simplicity or repetition within the musical stimulus. So, for example, children's tunes are particularly prone to getting stuck in listeners' heads.
In fact, I have one that I think may fit that category. Listen to this. You a moment ago referred to this whole phenomenon of tunes getting stuck in our heads as a cognitive itch. Can you explain to me what you mean by that?
Yes, just as certain biochemical agents, such as histamines, have physical properties that can cause an itch on our skin, certain pieces of music seem to have auditory properties that excite an itching kind of reaction in the brain. And of course, an itching sensation on the skin motivates scratching to alleviate the discomfort, and this only exacerbates the sensation, causing that familiar cycle of repeated itching and scratching. Well, by analogy, it seems that the only way to scratch a cognitive itch is to repeat the offending tune in our minds.
Obviously, the problem we all have with getting a tune stuck in our heads is that you can't seem to get it out. Or the only thing I've ever found effective is to find something that is just as repetitive but more pleasing you can substitute one for another and at least feel less bad about it, I guess.
Many people try these replacement strategies or distraction strategies. Still others use folkloric strategies to try to get rid of a stuck tune.
And what's that, for instance?
Well, for example, some people chew on cinnamon sticks and swear that that will make a stuck tune go away.
And you mentioned there are other folkloric remedies. What, for instance?
Some people play a game called tune cooties. They try to give the stuck tune to someone else and say, tag, you're it.
It's kind of a mean thing to do, don't you think?
It is, yes. Friends don't tag friends with tune cooties.
When you say that one way to deal with this cognitive itch is to hand it off to a friend, what do? You, not to a friend, to an enemy maybe. What do you do? Walk up to somebody you don't like and start whistling the Mission Impossible theme?
Sometimes it works like that. Sometimes people will say, hey, have you ever had a tune caught in your head? And if the person doesn't run away screaming with their hands covering their ears, then the next line would be, I have the Mission Impossible tune caught in my head, and tag, you're it.
The danger would be, though, I think that you'd go up to somebody and say, have you ever had a tune stuck in their head? And they immediately give you the one that's in their head.
I hate to admit it, but my secretary Rhinestone cowboyed me the other day in anticipation of being tagged.
Now, you have talked to a lot of people about this whole business. What's the longest time you've found anyone to get a song stuck in their head?
Well, one hapless respondent said that he had a jingle from a video game stuck in his head since 1986. But that was clearly the exception. The duration of the episodes of stuck tunes ranged from under an hour to as much as a week or more.
There is another one that I think has stuck in a lot of people's heads over the years. Maybe we could play that now.
I'm braced for it.
We're off to see the wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz. We hear he is the Wizard of Wiz, if ever a Wiz there was. If ever, oh, ever a Wiz there was, the Wizard of Oz is one. Because of the wonderful things he does. We're off to see the wizard.
I think I'm beginning to catch on. There is a kind of simplicity there, isn't there?
A simplicity, a repeating motif, a driving rhythm. That's a formula for disaster right there.
The only thing that I would think that would be of concern to you is that this could be dangerous to your health. Have you, in studying subjects, found yourself walking away with both It's a Small World and the Mission Impossible theme competing with each other in your head for attention?
Well, yes, it certainly was a occupational hazard, but I think I've become habituated to it. I do have some Charles Ives moments when there are multiple tunes clashing inside my head, but for the most part, I've become habituated to it, and it's not a problem.
You don't have one that's stuck in your head now?
I'm afraid to answer that question for fear of evoking the evil spirit of that tune. Well, yes, I've been working with Byzantine chant lately, so I have Byzantine chants floating around in my head constantly.
James Galaris teaches at the University of Cincinnati. He's still working on stuck song syndrome. And in the meantime, if you can't beat him...
It's a small world.
There are some things we'd love to forget. Other things we'd love to remember but can't. Daniel Schachter writes about both problems in his book, The Seven Sins of Memory. He told Steve Paulson the sins include transience, or forgetting over time, absent-mindedness, misattribution, a kind of memory distortion, and a sin called persistence, which can have dangerous consequences.
I tell one extreme story in the book of the pitcher Donnie Moore, who was relief pitcher for the California Angels and was pitching the final game of the 1986 playoff series against the Boston Red Sox. There were two out in the bottom of the ninth. He was on the verge of clinching the series. He had to get out one more batter. His team was up one run. Threw the pitch. The guy hit it out of the ballpark. The Angels lost the game and the series. And he became haunted by this memory. He simply could never get it out of his mind. Ultimately, he became an ineffective pitcher, became very depressed about this. His marriage broke up, and then tragically, he took his own life several years later. There's probably more going on than just that one memory to have such a horrible outcome, but his teammates, when interviewed, all said the memory of that pitch killed him. Hmm. Now, that may be overly simplistic, but it illustrates the power of persisting memories.
Mm-hmm. Do you know why some people have really good memories? I mean, just fantastic recall, whereas other people have just lousy memories?
That is a remaining mystery in memory research. I think as memory researchers, we've tended to focus on trying to understand what are the basic processes, what are the brain regions involved, you know, what are the different kinds of memory errors that we're subject to, and have concentrated less on trying to understand why one person has a better memory than another. You know, we can make some educated guesses based on our knowledge of basic memory. Some of it may relate to, for example, how much one knows about a particular domain. Often, it's not the case that one person has an across-the-board great memory and another person has a terrible one. It may be that for certain kinds of information or certain kinds of situations, one person is really good and the other person is not. This may relate to knowledge they already have about those domains. We know that when you know a lot about something, it's much easier to create new memories related to that. You know, there may be some inborn differences, but it's really a wide open area for future work.
Now, I see lots of ads these days touting various ways to improve our memory, everything from certain imagery techniques to ginkgo.
Right.
Do these things work?
Well, it depends. I talk a little bit about the evidence on ginkgo, and so far as we know now from scientific studies, they tend to show either no effect or, in a couple of cases, a very slight effect, but nothing that I would pin my hopes on if I was really looking for a significant improvement in memory. From the perspective of, for example, using imagery techniques or making associations that can promote memory, that can be helpful, particularly for countering transients, for making more durable memories that will hold up over time. The key thing there to keep in mind is that those techniques, while they will help you to counter transients, are often time-consuming. They require a little work on your part and are best used to help you with remembering specific body of information you want to learn. It's not the kind of thing where every day you're going to be walking around making up images and stories, but when you know there's a targeted bit of information that you need to know or body of knowledge you're studying for a test or the names that need to be learned, things of that sort, they can be really helpful.
Give me an example of how that might work.
For example, if I was a student and I was studying for a test, or if I was a business person and I had an important presentation the next day and there were certain things I wanted to remember, what I might do is use mental images, make up a story, for example, that would use bizarre mental images to make the lines I have to deliver in my business meeting memorable, or to, you know, make the information on the test more distinctive and memorable. But interestingly, those kinds of techniques are probably of limited use for other of these memory sins. For example, absent-mindedness. The best way to attack absent-mindedness is the use of reminders. There's an interesting person who I talk about in the book. Her name is Tatiana Cooley, and she illustrates very nicely the difference between transience and absent-mindedness. On the one hand, she's a national memory champion. Most people don't know there is such a thing, but there is. She won the National Memory Championship a couple of years ago by using imagery and other kinds of techniques to learn, you know, vast lists of numbers, words, card decks, and whatnot. And yet there was an article in the paper about her a couple of years ago where she admitted that she considers herself in her everyday life dangerously forgetful. She's totally dependent on sticky pads and notes and so on. She considers herself very absent-minded. That's because those techniques, elaboration and imagery, that are good for memorizing card decks or lists of numbers or a business presentation or a test, really are not things you can use on an ongoing basis in your everyday life.
Now, I'm sure we've all had the experience of not being able to remember a name or forgetting a phone number. Where it gets more complicated is when we're sure that our memory is accurate, but it turns out not to be. And I gather that this is a lot more common than we realize.
I think it is a lot more common than we realize because, for example, with misattribution, one of the really, which I consider, along with suggestibility, the two most dangerous of these memory sins, with that misattribution, what's so dangerous about it is that we often are remembering something accurately. So the memory feels so real that we just accept it to be real. And unless we're, you know, for some reason asked to measure that memory against some objective yardstick, we may not be aware that we're experiencing this memory distortion.
So have there been studies that have actually compared what people think is what really happened to what did happen?
Yep. There are a lot of these studies, many of them conducted in the last 5 years, and they show that even in normal, healthy people, it's relatively easy to induce memories of things that did not happen or did not happen as we remember them. In some cases, in a significant minority of the population, in some cases, in almost everyone. And one of the hallmarks of these misattributed memories is that people have very high confidence in them. They're absolutely sure that they're right, but we know, because we know what we presented to the participant in the experiment, we know that they're wrong.
Give me an example of how this might work.
Well, one very simple example is a wordless technique in which I read out a bunch of associated words. For example, one list that makes this point nicely includes the following words. Try to remember these. Candy, sour, sugar, bitter, good, taste, tooth, nice, honey, soda, chocolate, heart, cake, eat, pie. Okay, so that's a 15-word list, and I can test your memory on it in various ways. Now, one way to test your memory is through what we call a recognition memory test. I say to you, is this word on the list? Taste. Do you remember that one?
Oh, God, you're putting me on the spot.
I'm putting you right on the spot. Right?
No.
Okay, how about point?
I would have said no.
How about sweet?
No.
You say no to everything. Well, what happens in that case in many people is that about 70% will say yes to taste, and it really was on the list.
Okay, it was on the list.
It was. Most people will correctly say that point was not on the list. But then about 80% of people, and you weren't one of them this time, will claim with high confidence that sweet was on the list.
I will confess that I read that bit of your book.
So I knew that
all of these things, I mean, the common association was all these things were sweet.
Exactly.
But you didn't actually use the word sweet.
Right. And that's often what happens in misattribution, that what we're remembering is kind of the general sense of what's happened. The general sense of those 15 words was that, yeah, they're all related to sweet things, but sweet wasn't on there. So on the one hand, you know, that's actually a positive feature of memory. It's good to have a memory that holds on to the general sense or gist of what happens. But on the other hand, in cases where pinpoint accuracy is really important, as in the courtroom with eyewitnesses, it can be very dangerous if you have a memory that loses some of the specific details and leads you to make confident but inaccurate statements when you're talking at the level of exact detail.
Although when I hear you talk about this, I wouldn't trust anything that someone says in a courtroom. Who knows whether it's true or not, even if they are sure that they saw this.
Well, it is worrisome, and some of the statistics that have come out on wrongful conviction of people have now been exonerated by DNA evidence are rather disturbing. Of the first 40 cases of people who'd been exonerated on the basis of DNA, 36 of those individuals were put in jail, at least partly, in some cases entirely, on the basis of mistaken eyewitness identification. However, I think that we don't need to go so far as to say that all memory is always inaccurate and can never be trusted. But we do have to look at eyewitness testimony with an eye toward the possibility of these kinds of things happening. We need to look for other corroborating evidence. We need to look at, you know, the conditions under which information is taken in. We need to look at whether there have been suggestive questions asked to witnesses, which can greatly enhance this kind of memory error. And there are better and worse ways of, for example, of presenting lineups for eyewitnesses. We're starting to learn about some of the more effective ways of presenting lineups in ways that minimize these errors. So I think we don't want to move to the extreme of never depending on memory, but we need to move away from an uncritical acceptance of particularly of confident memory.
Daniel Schachter, talking with Steve Paulson about his book, The Seven Sins of Memory.
Try to remember the kind of September when life was slow and oh so mellow. Try to remember the kind of September, when grass was green and grain was yellow. Try to remember the kind of September when you were a young and callow fellow. Try to remember, and if you remember, then follow, follow.
Just ahead, life in the past perfect tense, or the seduction of nostalgia. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Past or present, there's no place like home.
Slow hoist up the jumpy, hoist up the jumpy. See how the mainsail, see how the mainsail. Call for the captain ashore. Let me go home, let me go home. I wanna go home, let me go home. Hoist up the jumpy,
hoist up the jumpy.
Feel so broke up.
The sloop John B., as nostalgic a song as ever there was. Well, anyway, admitting you're nostalgic can be a little embarrassing. It's kind of like eating a whole pie yourself. Too sweet. Too indulgent. But Svetlana Boym, author of The Future of Nostalgia, says it wasn't always like this. She told Anne Strangechamps, nostalgia used to be considered a credit to the afflicted.
It was invented in 17th century by a Swiss doctor who was defending his doctoral thesis. And he claimed that the nostalgia is a disease of afflicted imagination, and it's very characteristic for Swiss mercenary soldiers or domestic help or students who were working or serving abroad. And he believed that it is an aggravated physical illness, but it's a curable disease, and it can be cured with opium leeches and returned back to Swiss Alps.
He thought it was actually a physical disease?
Yes, yes, with specific symptoms, and he believed that return home will cure the condition of nostalgia.
Well, it might have, but what kinds of symptoms was he seeing in these soldiers who had nostalgia?
They would tend to faint, have high fever, indigestion, stomach problem, and sometimes it led to death. Apparently, they were sometimes confusing symptoms of nostalgia and symptoms of tuberculosis. The interesting thing happened in the end of 18th century, that they could no longer find a locus or a place of nostalgia. They were looking for something they called nostalgic bone, like now, you know, scientists are always looking for a gene that is responsible for everything. They were looking for nostalgic bone, and they couldn't find it, so they didn't know if the locus of nostalgia is in a person's brain or is it in the outside world? Because nostalgia is really a relationship between one's individual memory and one's homeland.
I'm surprised that soldiers would be willing to admit to being, I don't know, so weakened by a simple longing for their home that they'd fall ill. They'd think that was kind of, I don't know, unmanly.
It's an excellent question because, in fact, Swiss doctors thought that it's a patriotic disease. But, of course, it reveals all the problems of patriotism. You love your motherland so much that you don't wish to be away from it or, for that matter, to die for it. But in the Russian army in 18th century, there was an epidemic of nostalgia. So then the Russian general said that we're going to bury people alive if they continue complaining of nostalgia. And apparently he buried one soldier alive and the epidemic stopped.
Nobody would want to admit to it after that.
But Americans, if Swiss at least thought it's a disease of patriotism that shows some imagination, American doctors were particularly critical of nostalgia. And they claimed that Americans do not have nostalgia because it's a young nation and it doesn't suffer from the diseases of the old world. However, during the Civil War, during the American Civil War, American doctors also discovered symptoms of nostalgia, and they described it as an unmanly and unprogressive disease.
You said that at first nostalgia could be cured by a return to the homeland, to a real home, but nostalgia has evolved to be, in our parlance today, in some ways the idea of a longing for a home that doesn't exist or that may never have have existed. How did that happen?
Well, sometimes when the doctors would return patients home, their symptoms would get worse. So then they decided that philosophers and poets should take care of nostalgia, that it's not merely a medical condition. And they also discovered that in a way it was a disease of modernity, very much connected to the conception of progress and the idea of irreversible time. So that in a way nostalgia is not so much longing for place, but also longing for another time, which could be a time of one's childhood or some imaginary golden age. So then in the 19th century, nostalgia very closely connected to romantic nationalism, the idea of returning back to some kind of ideal national homeland. And I discovered that in various East European languages, for instance, there is a word for nostalgia that they claim to be untranslatable in Russian Tuska, in Polish Tisknota, and so on. But all of these words are actually synonyms.
You're an immigrant yourself. Have you yourself experienced nostalgia very much?
You know, when I immigrated, which was in 1981, I came to the United States actually as a political refugee from Soviet Union. I was born in Leningrad, USSR. Neither my city nor my country exists. But when I came to America, there was a certain taboo on nostalgia. You were not supposed to look back. And I discovered that first wave of immigrants often shares that. It's their children who dream of returning home. The immigrants were too busy to leave their home. And, you know, I was frequently asked the question, do you miss your homeland? And I would usually say, well, yes, but it's not what you mean, or no, but it's not what you mean. I think it was very difficult to translate the ambivalence that I felt, both about my former homeland and about my new homeland. Because I think we believe that nostalgia is also very dangerous, because it is linked to dangerous idealization of the past, that instead of history, you speak about heritage, and heritage is something you're not supposed to question. So I'm very aware of that dangerous dimension of what I would call restorative nostalgia that tries to restore the past as some kind of a golden age.
Can you explain that a bit more? What is dangerous about nostalgia? Mm-hmm.
What is dangerous about nostalgia is the uncritical view of the past. The past is sort of, you know, tinted in pink, and it's forever opposed to the present. But also, as I mentioned, historically, nostalgia was linked to romantic nationalism, which, of course, had many important aspects to it, but it was also linked to this idea of inventing traditions. Living traditions change. They're flexible. Invented traditions, when you invent most traditional religious society or most traditional national community, you tend to invent tradition which becomes extremely rigid. And so nostalgia substitutes for critical reflection, and that kind of what I call restorative nostalgia can be dangerous.
To take us into the very present, would you say that Osama bin Laden's crusade against the U.S. is at least in part motivated by nostalgia?
Yes, I know it's a very polemical idea, but I see that sort of return to fundamentalism as a perfect example of this invention of tradition. I read that the founder of the Jihad in Egypt movement, and his name escapes me right now, was actually initially a modernist literary critic who went to America in the 1940s, spent some time there, and was particularly disgusted by the way people danced in New York City. So returning home, he kind of created that sort of nostalgic vision of a perfect Islamic society that never was. I used to study medieval Spain, you know, and I know a lot about medieval Muslim culture that, of course, was nothing like what they're trying to recreate now. And in fact, in Spain, Jews and Muslims cohabited very peacefully, and there was a lot of cultural development. It was hardly that kind of orthodox and fanatic return to religion as we see now. So I really see that as a very modern phenomenon.
Is nostalgia continuing to evolve?
I think so. I'm not sure how, but I discovered, for instance, I believe that perhaps the discovery of the internet revolution, is the end of nostalgia. Because nostalgia is about irreversibility of time, right? That, you know, you cannot physically return to your childhood. But internet proposed a very different model, spatial model, you know, of hypertext. So I thought maybe on the internet everything is available, you know, you have a very different model of memory. Maybe it's the end of nostalgia. But then I opened once a cyberpunk page, and it was all dedicated to nostalgia. It said something that cyberpunks are not what they used to be.
So even on the internet, you can't go home again.
You can't. And even then, now there is a nostalgia for the idea of cyberspace as opposed to e-world, e-world being commercialized cyberspace and cyberspace being a sort of an image of, you know, kind of autonomous free zone, free space, utopian free space. So, yes, you can't even go back to the virtual home.
Svetlana Boyen spoke with Anne Strainchamps about her book, The Future of Nostalgia. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced by Steve Paulson, Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, Anne Strainchamps, Mary Lou Finnegan, and Leo Duran, with engineering help from Marv Nunn and Kirill Wheeler. You can buy a tape of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Memory on the Mind, number 1111A.
PRI, Public Radio International.